Welcome to the Brown Mama Blueprint Podcast, the official podcast of Healthy Start, Inc., where we keep it all the way 100 on how to live your best brown mama life with tips, advice, interviews, and stories on Black Mommin' for Life, hosted by speaker, author, influencer, and advocate of all things brown mama, Muffy Mendoza.
What's up, y'all? It's Muffy Mendoza back for another episode of the Brown Mama Blueprint Podcast. As always, I have some dope women with me here to interview. I know y'all enjoyed the last episode where we went really, really deep on Black women and birthing and all the things we experienced. And I'm so excited for this second episode because we have some really dope women to talk about Black and poverty. And it's not my favorite subject, but it's a subject that I think needs to be broken down. And when I tell y'all, Miss Tammy Thompson is here and she is going to break it all the way down. I've never heard a woman talk about poverty the way she talks about it. And we also have Miss Lisa Doctor. First of all, let me get that right. Doctor,
yeah.
Lisa Pickett here to talk with us about her lived experience in poverty. And she is also a teacher at the high school level in a Black school. So she has all types of wisdom and all types of experiences that we can glean wisdom from. So welcome to the Brown Mama Blueprint Podcast, ladies. Can you introduce yourself?
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Hey, doctor, we gotta let Dr. Lisa go first.
Go ahead, Dr. Lisa.
Thank you, ladies. Yes, I'm Dr. Lisa Pickett. And I am a Pittsburgh resident. I'm a mother of three children. I have a beautiful daughter who is 22, fresh out of college, a son who is 10, and a son who is 6. And I am a teacher, just like Muffy said. Thank you for that introduction.
All right. I'm just so excited to be here. I love everything Muffy does. And I love Lisa. I've been watching Lisa from a distance. Her energy is awesome. So super happy to be here. I'm Tammy Thompson. I am also a Pittsburgh resident, mother of 5, grandmother of 19. Love my grandbabies. The poverty expert title. That's a title that was given to me. I did not choose it.
But that is what you are.
But I will assume that, I feel like my experiences in poverty definitely qualify me for that, but also the work that I do a lot of work around poverty issues and educating folks about the real poverty, how real people are impacted by it, but specifically Black people and how Black people have been impacted by it and continue to be impacted.
And I do feel the need to just toot her horn a little bit more because Tammy is one of those people that is high level, but she's in the trenches every day. The things she does in our community for moms, for their children, for people, this woman has a heart for people. When the pandemic hit, Tammy was in the trenches. She was getting the laptop, serving the food, doing everything that people needed in order to be able to survive. So if I'm able to, I'm just going to put some hand claps right here because this woman, I think y'all need to know that it is an honor for her to be present with us today because she is really doing the work. When we're talking about people doing the work of eradicating poverty, we don't often get to speak to the people who are really doing the work. And so I just consider it an honor to have her here, to have her as somebody we can call on in the community. So thank you, thank you, thank you so much, Tammy, for the work that you've done because you deserve... You just deserve a lot of praise for what you do for us.
Yeah, definitely.
So we're going to start out right there because I think it's important. Storytelling is a vehicle for helping people understand. It is also a vehicle for helping people feel related to and feel like they are heard. So I want to start there and just having you ladies tell our audience a little bit about your experiences in poverty. Like, what is your poverty story?
Ooh, I don't even know where to start with that. You mentioned the pandemic and some of the work that I honestly felt compelled to do when the pandemic hit. And I'll be very honest and transparent. You guys know I don't really know any other way. I was severely triggered. A lot of my past trauma was extremely triggered by the pandemic. A lot of the work that I jumped in and did was a direct reflection of my trauma and how I was triggered by the thought of people not having enough food, not having diapers or formula or wipes or personal hygiene, all the stuff that I remember not having when I was raising my kids, all the stuff that I remember my mother not having when she was raising me and my brother. And so I couldn't quite put my finger on what I was feeling when all of this first happened. I just felt a force, something that was just like, you got to do something, you got to do something. And when I finally got a chance to slow down and think about why I was, there was so much anxiety around what was happening, I realized that I was, my trauma was my, you know, I was suffering from a form of PTSD and a remembrance of what it felt like to not have your most basic needs met. And I just wanted to try to prevent other people from feeling that. My poverty story is way too long for this podcast. It's long. But what I will tell you is that some of my first memories are as a child are of things that I did not have. Of watching my parents really struggle. You know, we had a lot of good times too as kids, but some of the standout memories that I have are of not having our basic needs met, not having enough food, not having anywhere to live, being homeless, being hungry. And all of the byproducts emotionally and psychologically that come with not having your most basic needs met. I ended up becoming an adult, a young adult who fell into the cycle of generational poverty, became a teenage mom, suffered a lot of guilt around that, and struggled raising my own children. Multiple bouts of homelessness and, you know, not being in the dark, having your electricity cut off, the gas off, the water off, trying to figure out how to, you know, divvy up 5 plates of food when you really only had enough food for 2. You know, these are the things that I remember. And I remember most what it felt like to not want to ask for help. You know, they're not wanting to ask for help when I really, really needed it, because I felt, you know, I knew what society saw when they looked at me. I knew, you know, how the disdain that people have for particularly Black single mothers. You know, there's a disdain in this society for Black single mothers. There's a disdain in this society for Black mothers, period. But when you add single, teenage, poor, uneducated to the mix, there's a special amount of judgment held for that group of women. And I felt it everywhere I went. Whether it was real or not, whether it was real or perceived, it was my reality. And so it gave me reluctance to ask for help. And so I suffered, I think, probably a lot more than I should have, just because I would have rather gone hungry than to see the look of judgment in a lot of people's faces. So, you know, my children, now that they're adults, they, you know, we talk about the experiences that they had as a result of, you know, our poverty and the things that we didn't have. And it breaks my heart to think that my kids are still carrying the stuff that they remember, what they didn't have, you know, the most basic needs that they didn't have. So yeah, the story is, it's a long story of poverty, because, you know, people look at me now and they're like, oh my God, you're so successful. You've done all these wonderful things. But really, it's been maybe 8 years that I haven't had to worry about, you know, my rent my utilities, my, how is there enough food? It hasn't been that long. I'm 51 years old. So the bulk of my life has been surviving poverty. And it's a rough journey. So everything that I do now is focused on those experiences and developing programming and developing assistance and support for people who are experiencing every single thing that I did. And that's just, you know, that's really important to me.
Hey, Brown Mamas. It's evident what we all have in common, motherhood. It's one of the hardest but most rewarding responsibilities ever. Healthy Start wants to make sure that you are good from day one. Our lives are on the line, but together we got this. From prenatal education to mental health support, our team covers all bases. We'll even bring you diapers every month. We partner with other community-based and grassroots organizations and Black birth workers to make sure you have a village. We're also working to effect change within our healthcare system and have stepped up our services to make sure you have support during the pandemic. Visit our website at HealthyStartPittsburgh.org to learn more about our doula services, the Healthy Start Center for Urban Breastfeeding, our programming for fathers, and more. Or give us a call at 412-247-4009. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Get with the Brown Mama program today and start building your village with Healthy Start.
Thank you.
Yes, I mean, I agree with everything that you say, totally echo everything, because it just listening to you speak really resonates with me, because as a teacher, my experiences and adversity with poverty, it really influenced, you know, my ability to teach in a positive way, which I would have never expected growing up as a young lady, because I always carried a tremendous amount of shame. Mm-hmm. And there's just the trauma of that shame. It really influenced who I became, mm-hmm. which later on it blossomed into something really positive that today, now when I teach, I can connect and have so much empathy and see things about my students and know how to support them from that, from the poverty and the adversity. But like you said, the journey was so long, and it was so traumatizing that even to this day, now that I function, but I can still feel it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I have a steady income. I'm a teacher, and, you know, I'm able to support my family, but always in the back of my mind, I think, okay, I could be one or two or three paychecks away from poverty if I make one wrong move. Absolutely. If I make, you know, like one bad decision. And I know that is directly influenced by, you know, my experiences of poverty. There's always that fear, mm-hmm. that you could make a mistake and go back. So, you know, with that being said, my story, it started from the time I was born, because both of my parents, they didn't work because they suffered from mental illnesses. They were functioning mentally ill. Now, they had functional illnesses that were they were still allowed to have their children. We were still allowed to stay with them, but they couldn't work. So we were always in poverty. We were always in the projects. We always had cash assistance. We always had medical assistance. We were always in lines at the Salvation Army. All of our clothes came from donations from people. We were always at the Goodwills. I didn't even know what McDonald's was, yeah. You know, as a young child. If we went to McDonald's, we would all put together our money and we would split a small fry, yeah. because we literally just did not have, you know, money for those types of luxuries. We didn't have a car. We never had things like name brand food and clothes like that. We always had generic. So poverty really ran deep. Everywhere I went in all of my family members' homes, they were all struggling with their ability to function and exist financially, which trickled down into our education, the way we moved, the way we acted. I remember never letting anybody go into my grandmother's house because I was just so full of shame that she was so poor. You know, when I got older, just thinking about it, the guilt of that shame. But of course, I was young. I didn't know then. My grandma was such a sweetheart, yeah. you know, and she did the best that she could. And later on, I really felt bad about the fact that I didn't want anybody to come in our house because it would clearly represent the fact that we were poor. But my grandmother, bless her heart, if she had two pieces of bacon and 10 people came in our house, she would split that bacon, you know, with everyone.
Yes.
So it was definitely a journey. Even when I went to college, I remember being embarrassed because I didn't have the necessary things that I needed. And so I would keep it a secret. and I would go to the financial aid office and we would sit down and I would talk to the advisor and we would talk about different ways that I could, you know, be supported. And I remember moving in with a group of girls and I was on welfare and I had financial assistance. I had food stamps and I had cash assistance. And I was so embarrassed and ashamed to say that because I just felt, like you said, that strong sense, you know, of shame. And had it not been for, I truly believe, had it not been for me going to college, I think that that really helped me because it gave me access and exposure to resources that I didn't have, you know, in the past. Because when I look at my family, many of them still struggle, you know, with trying to figure out how can they make moves to make the first few steps without suffering and losing, you know, certain things. Because we all know that if you're getting cash assistance or food assistance and you get a little pay raise,
it's over. And this is exactly why I do the work that I do, training other nonprofit organizations and government agencies with the psychology of poverty training that I develop. Because people for so long have made this a financial issue, right? You know, it's a financial issue. If people would learn how to budget, if they would learn how to save, if they wouldn't do this, if they wouldn't do that. Poverty is not just about money, right? The cost of poverty is so much bigger than the financial cost. The psychological and emotional cost for people to be exposed to poverty long-term is so detrimental. It literally is soul killing. It is soul killing, it is spirit killing. And what made me think of this is when you talked about the impact on the children, right? The impact on a child and children who have never known anything else, right? And for us not to connect, you know, I always want people to think about poverty similar to veterans from in the armed forces, people who go off the war and they come home and they have PTSD. It is a very real thing. It is the exact same thing that many, many, many people in our communities are suffering with and don't even know it. You don't even recognize the impact of not having your most basic needs met, having to fight and scratch for every little thing, not being able to adequately express how that makes you feel, how it makes you feel to experience it, but how it makes you feel to see the people that you love most experience it, and how that settles into your soul and into your psyche. It is every single person who has experienced poverty long-term is suffering from PTSD. That is one, I believe that with everything in me, because how could they not? How could you not? The things that we see, the things that we endure, the things that we feel, the isolation, when you talked about the secrecy and the hiding and the shame and the guilt, it creates a certain level of isolation. That prevents you from being able to move forward. It prevents you from being able to see the world in a certain way. It prevents you from being able to see yourself in a certain way, right? So it impacts your self-esteem and your self-worth and, you know, how you see opportunity. And it's very important that we understand that.
And I think I wanted to point out that that's one of the reasons why the trainings that Tammy does are so important with the psychology of poverty, because what we have to understand is that oftentimes people that are living in poverty, they know something is wrong, but they have no idea how to make the mindset changes necessary to eradicate it. So we really have to start taking the onus off of people to ask for help. And the people that recognize that, okay, poverty is going on here, need to be the people taking the onus to say, what do you need? How can I help you? How can I help you develop a different mindset? What can I do to make sure that the processes and procedures for you to get from your house to the food bank, from your house to the bank, from your house to supportive institutions, how do we remove those barriers? And we have to take the onus off of the people in poverty, because we know that in this country, poverty is systemic. It's not something that's just happening randomly. It's not something that's happening because of a specific occasion. It's happening systemically, meaning there are processes, procedures, policies, laws, and social norms that are all encouraging poverty amongst certain segments of people. So we really have to get off of this thing where we are saying, okay, well, we're just going to make it easier for so-and-so to open up a bank account. That's not going to remove poverty, because there's a whole mindset with opening up a bank account. I have to even believe I'm worthy of opening up a bank account. I have to believe I can save money. So we have to remove that onus, recognizing that the people who are in poverty are oftentimes operating in our very midst. And we don't know it because they don't even have the vocabulary. They don't have the gumption. They're so ashamed of the position that they're in that they're not going to tell us that this is going on. So I just feel, especially since we know that health practitioners may be listening in, other subject matter experts may be listening in to this podcast.
Educators. We have people like Lisa as educators. So understands the impact of poverty and how it's impacting our children's minds and how they view themselves and how they view their communities and how they see their future. Right? There is a reason why you see kids who are like, oh, okay, well, what's the point? My mom has a high school diploma up on the mantle too. And she's killing herself going to work every day for pennies. No, thanks. I don't want to part of that. Right. So we got to think about all of that. And I don't think we do, because this society has created this individualistic thought process around poverty. Well, if you're poor, it's because you didn't do something. You didn't do enough. You didn't try enough. You didn't work hard enough. You're not smart enough. You want to be poor. You like being lazy. You want a handout, right? And it's this way of shifting the blame when we know that some of these policies and systems that have been created that keep people poor were intentional.
Yes.
Created to do that. And they continue to perpetuate that. And the psychological warfare that's been used to say to somebody, well, you're only in this position because of what you've done or haven't done, is a cop out. And it's a way to erase history. It's a way to erase blame and shift blame and not accept responsibility for the fact that it was intentionally done. And that really burns my soul.
And that's what we're going to talk about next. And Lisa, you can chime in first. What is systemic poverty? Mm-hmm. What is the difference between systemic poverty and just being poor? And does that even exist? Does just being poor even really exist?
Yeah, I think when we think about that question, it's so hard to blend the two together, because if you're born into poverty and it's a part of your family, it's generational, it's so difficult to separate the two, because like Tammy said, you'll have people who will say you're poor because of the decisions that you made and you had a choice. And if you would have made some better decisions, you would be better off. But when it's systemic, it is so hard to be able to step away from that, because it is ingrained in the narrative and it's hard to shift from that, especially if you have spaces where you feel like you have no worth and no value. And then you're afraid to go and seek opportunity and seek guidance and seek resources so that you can step away from the systemic and create your own possibilities, which is challenging. And then the other challenge, once again, that Tammy brought up, is that sometimes we can be in it and be a part of the systemic factors and not even know it. And that's the hardest part, when you're walking blindly and have no idea that you are a part of this narrative that was created generations ago. To make sure that we as African Americans don't have access to certain things, which is challenging, which is why, once again, it always brings me back to the classroom. When I share these types of ideas and we have these very discussions in my classroom, it's amazing to watch how students, their perspective shifts when they're given the knowledge and the access to the vocabulary to know there is something called systemic. And there is something called systemic poverty, and there's something called systemic racism. And when they start to realize, wait a minute, that's a real thing, then they become more aware and they're able to move differently and they're able to make better decisions, as opposed to thinking that something's wrong with them or something was wrong with their mom or something was wrong with their dad. And if they would have made, once again, better decisions, if they would have just pulled themselves up, you know, by their bootstraps, that same cliche we hear all the time, things would be better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tough question, because I think all poverty is systemic. honestly. I think all of it is because it's all connected to a system somehow, right? Even if you think about people who weren't born into poverty but ended up there through, let's just use health or medical issues as an example. Someone who went bankrupt because they got sick, or somebody, one of their loved ones got sick and they didn't have proper health insurance. Because really, if you really get sick, most of us don't have good health insurance, believe that. That's a systemic issue that contributes to poverty. And I've seen people actually go from doing well to being in search of Medicaid and food stamps because of health issues that drove them first out of work and then, you know, bankrupt because they couldn't pay their medical bill. You know, I know people who were divorced. Maybe they were doing fine and then they got divorced. And because of, you know, one partner making more money and the woman stayed home, maybe because she chose, well, they made a decision that she was going to take care of the children and she didn't have any work history and she couldn't build any credit and she didn't have anything in her name. Now she's poor with children. And I've seen all of that, right? But then when you think about systemic poverty, think about how deeply layered it is from the education system. But we can start from historically. Think about the things that create generational wealth and how Black people were intentionally and legally forced out of those spaces, unable to purchase homes, unable to take advantage of GI bills, unable to, even if they had the money, not allowed to move into communities that to this day garner you, white families are benefiting from being able to purchase in a certain neighborhood and the market value has gone up over generations and that family has benefited 3, 4, 5, 10-fold. Where a family who wasn't permitted, who had the money and could have purchased, but wasn't permitted to move into that neighborhood and had to move into a neighboring Black only neighborhood that didn't increase in market value over the generations, right? So all of this stuff, that's systemic. And it's systemic racism that has contributed to systemic poverty. Think about the education system and how we weren't even allowed to go to college. There were certain schools we couldn't get into. Our children couldn't go to school, our grandparents. Think about all of the stuff that was government sanctioned, like redlining and, you know, all of this stuff that we have lost generations of wealth. And people, this is what really burns me up, because people, the same people who are talking about bootstrapping and I didn't, nobody helped me. You did get help because you probably living in your granddaddy's house right now, or you're at least benefiting from your grandparents passing money down and helping your parents buy their first house. Like, so don't, please. Like, we know that this stuff happened and it's still happening to a degree under the radar because people aren't paying attention. And that's one thing that this is why we have to stay politically engaged. Because if we take our feet, if we take our eyes off of these folks for 5 minutes, they will reverse everything that was created to give us even a chance to compete economically. So we have to keep our eyes on the prize and continue to fight, because they'll take it away in a heartbeat if they could. So systemic racism, including the education system, think about how your education and the quality of the education that you get is related to a boundary and what neighborhood you live in. Think about lending practices. Think about wages. Who has the majority of low wage jobs around the country? Think about the criminal justice system and how our men predominantly have been taken out of their families, creating these single parent, how many single parent households have been created because someone's locked away for a crime that a white counterpart got a slap on the wrist on. Like, all of these things are systemic and contribute to our economic position right now. You know, we can go on and on. Think about Greenwood Week. Think about Black Wall Street. Think about how the minute we got our hands on something that was just ours, it was taken away, right? So we have to consider all of these things when we're thinking about the causes of poverty and the perpetuation of poverty, because it is not, and I will fight against this until my last breath, this is not an individualistic issue. This is not a personal accountability issue. And believe me, I believe in personal accountability as much as the next person, but personal accountability is not going to get people out of poverty. It is not going to change the conditions of our communities that have been intentionally devastated and disinvested in. So we have to be clear about that, and we have to talk about it on a regular basis, because that, again, that guilt that we have inherently, because we feel, even if people don't know they feel it, it's in there. We feel like we should have more, or I should have done something else, and I feel bad because I don't have this and I don't have that. It is not your fault. It is not your fault. Do we have to do our part to get what we can get and get the information and get the education and invest and save and focus on healing ourselves? Absolutely. But what is happening in our communities, what is happening around us, what has been happening to Black people for generations, we did not do this to ourselves. And we have to alleviate that, because once people shift that thought process and realize, listen, don't listen to these people. You can get this. You can do that. You can get out of survival mode. Then it shifts how people move forward. And that's just really, we really just have to focus on that.
Right. And then the other challenging part is really just having access to the education and the resources, which is systemic in and of itself. Like if you have an African-American family who is totally unaware of credit scores, mm-hmm. or inability to even obtain financial resources like loans, mm-hmm. to maybe start a small business or to build that credit, or even access to a particular job, you know, access to a particular promotion, because there could be this underlying belief that no, we're not going to promote African-Americans past this position because we don't want them to take over. Like I remember literally being told in one of the positions that I had early on in my career that they were shocked that I was hired because they already had an African-American. And why did they need another one? And things like that, if you imagine, if that's happening all over the United States, there are plenty of African-Americans who are qualified, you know, and ready to go and make moves. But if they're not given access to that, that is systemic, because they're not given access to build their income, to get experience. Because if I listen to a lot of my white counterparts and they talk about all the things that they had access to when they were growing up and when they went to college, maybe they had a college plan. You know, they had a parent that was able to give them, you know, things that I could have never imagined having there for me. I knew going in, you know, as I grew up, that there wasn't going to be a support system. Mm-hmm. If I was going to get it, I was going to have to figure it out, you know, on my own, which is, once again, I go back to when it comes to poverty, I knew that my mistakes needed to be limited. Mm-hmm. And that's the one thing that I feel was challenging about, you know, poverty, in that from my perspective and from my experiences, having to live a life where you feel like you cannot make any mistakes is traumatizing. Because it's impossible. So when I would listen to some of my white colleagues and friends laugh about certain things that they did, you know, throughout their life, I thought, I would have never done those things, never. Because I knew that if I did and I made the wrong step, I could end up back in the projects. I could end up back on welfare. I could be struggling to take care of my kids and provide food. Like, I don't plan vacations. I don't do certain things unless I'm absolutely positively sure that I can do it and know that I can still pay my mortgage and I can still pay my bills, because that fear is always there. Fear that they don't necessarily have, because they have the resources and the access to do that. So Muffy, when you say, you know, the question about it being systemic and, you know, is there a difference? I'm not quite sure that there is when it comes to African-Americans, because it's ingrained in our narrative, you know, in the history of race in America.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that we also, for the Black women who are listening here, well, for most, actually for other women who are listening here, when you see a Black woman who's been able to attain a certain social status, that's been able to attain a certain professional status, what you need to know is many times, not all the time, but many times what you are looking at is somebody who has clawed their way out of poverty. Mm-hmm. They have made as few mistakes as they possibly can. To Lisa's point, they have been able to skip over things like payday loans and some of the stuff I wrote down, mental health issues they maybe had to address, property loss, redlining. This, you're not looking at somebody who was just born that way. You're looking at someone who really, really had to make some, sometimes very hard decisions, you know, and that oftentimes meant overcoming thought processes that were constantly trying to take her out of here. So I think it's important because a lot of times when, you know, people from other cultures see us, they have this thought, which is, oh, you're the exception to the rule. No, that's not the truth.
That is so true. And that's why I think sometimes I get overly excited and, you know, the younger generation, they're like, why is she so excited? Why is she so passionate? I'm like, you have no idea the life that I have lived to get to where, you know, I am. So I'm eager to want to help the younger generation, but I've learned I have to do it, you know, with ease and not be too excited because then you could scare some people away. But, you know, like you said, that idea, like sometimes people will look at me and they'll say, oh, you must have come from a really great family, or you had to have, you know, come from a life that was full of privilege. And I'm like, no, what you see now is not, you know, what I was. It took a lot of work and a lot of hard effort. I've had those beneficial loans where the interest rate was like 28%.
Listen, you know, exactly. Right. Exactly. So I come from a generation where we were told that the only way to get a decent paying job and be able to live was to go to college. It was the only way. And if you didn't go to college, then you were going to be poor. You were going to be, what did my mom used to call it? Shoveling fries. You're going to be shoveling fries for the rest of your life. Because when I was in high school, I worked at Burger King. And she said that almost every day. And so for me, I was like, oh, well, the only option for getting, you know, a decent job was going to college. It was sold, and I'm sorry, a lot of people are going to disagree with this, but this is another one of those government sanctioned principles that contribute to systemic poverty. And from my perspective, systemic racism is the student loan system. Most poor Black families, most, not all, many, I'll just say many, the only way their children could go to college was to get a student loan. The only way. That was the only way. So my mother constantly was telling me, you're going to college. You're going, I don't care. You can be out here acting the fool all you want, but you're going to college. But never had any idea, plan for how I was going to pay for it. So we knew the only option, like most of the families that I knew, the only option was to go into debt to do it. Now, going into debt, I'm thinking about Pittsburgh right now. You go into debt, you're told you get this education, you come out, you're going to be fine. That's not true, because going to college and getting a degree, you can't control the labor market. We know people right now with multiple degrees that can't earn enough money to live, pay your living expenses, save a little bit, and pay your student loan debt, right? It's so challenging to put that in people's head that accumulating all of this debt, and then you're going to get out and you're just going to get a job and life is going to be great. And you're no longer, that's not what's happening, right? That's not, it used to be the case, but we've got to adjust our thinking to what's happening in this country right now. And what's happening in this country right now is an increase in capitalism. And we've created this capitalistic society where it's been designed that only that small percentage of people is controlling our entire labor market. Right. So the odds of you being able to go to college and come home and earn enough money to, you know, live, especially depending on how you started your life. For me, for instance, when I tried to go to college, and I never finished. When I tried to go, I was raising five babies by myself. So I already have five kids, was working a full-time job and trying to go to school full-time. It didn't work, right? And there's a lot of people who are stuck with college debt, haven't been able to find a job, particularly in this city, that is comparable to pay back your student loans and live. Think about how everything has increased: the cost of living, the cost of housing, the cost of daycare, the cost of food, the cost of the cost of everything has gone up. But what hasn't gone up? Wages. Wages haven't gone up. Wages do not meet or match the cost of living. And so when you add that insurmountable student loan debt to that, where are we? In a lot of cases, people are more poor now than they were before they incurred that student loan debt. Not only are they more poor, but now they also, the door to the opportunity of creating legacy assets like home ownership is closed to them because their debt ratio doesn't work. Their ability to start a business, door closed, because you can't borrow enough money for capital to get started because you have that insurmountable student loan debt. That debt has become an albatross around people's necks that is keeping the door of opportunity for asset building closed. And that is why I say it is a perpetuation of the laws that were in place, the housing discrimination laws that were put in place that prevented us from buying two generations ago. Now we have this new barrier to purchasing, which is student loan debt. And so, you know, I got feelings about it. I think there's things that we need to be encouraging our children to think about beyond borrowing if they have to borrow. Think about how much you're borrowing. Think about reducing that debt. Do your best to not try to fully fund your entire college education with debt, because it's just perpetuating the cycle of poverty.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because I've noticed, I want to say in the past 10 years with my students that I teach, there was a shift where a lot of them were doing the first 2 years at schools that were less expensive, yeah, like a community college, so they could save money, and then they would transfer to like a Pitt or any of our other local universities that were a little bit more expensive, just so they could save money. And I thought, wow, that's a definite shift.
So smart, because when I was going to school, and some folks a little bit younger than me were trying to go to college, they were absolutely turned against going to a community college. It was something else to be ashamed of. It was another thing to be looked down upon. You're not going to get a job with a community college education. People told us that.
Yeah, and then we also need to, it goes beyond us in terms of politics and just our country in general. And then why are these loan companies allowed to charge so much, you know, at interest? I'll never forget, I called to make a student loan payment and they wanted me to pay them to pay them. Like I had to pay it like $11 or $15 fee to pay them. And I couldn't help but say, why do I have to pay you? And you're already making over $50,000 off of the life of my loan. You already got a $50,000 profit. And I remember just debating and thinking, I wish that there was a way to supersede that and go above and beyond that, where they're held accountable, where like in other countries, their education is paid for.
Yep. Well, I'll tell you, part of it is this is part of the systemic issues that we're talking about, because lenders, banks can afford to lobby politicians to be allowed to do stuff like that. There's a reason that they are not as regulated as they should be. There's a reason why they're allowed to get away with a lot of the lending practices that they have, because they spend a lot of money to lobby politicians to make sure that nobody's watching them.
And I currently have an 18-year-old who just graduated from high school in 2020. And let me tell y'all, if the president of the United States or the former president of the United States child was allowed to take a gap year,
right,
you can allow your child to take a gap year. Right. Because a lot of times we're sending children to college that don't even need to be there. Right. They haven't figured out what their gift is. They don't know what their purpose is. What about allowing your child the time to actually find their gift and then finding a way they can monetize their gift? I just think before any child makes a decision to spend any money on education, they need to get their degree in YouTube University. Mm-hmm. Once you've gotten your degree in YouTube University, then I know you have come away with some knowledge and understanding of what you want to do. Find you that person who is doing the best at that skill and listen to their videos. Because a lot of times we send our kids off to college and they don't even, that's not, they decide by junior year, they don't even want to do that.
Want to be there. And not, you know, like me, still sitting here with debt that I didn't even get a degree for.
Listen, I got a degree in journalism.
Yeah.
And guess what I was doing in college? I was working for a newspaper and nobody told me, well, do you realize you already work for me? Right.
Exactly. But again, you know what? Listen, I hate to keep always taking us back to race, but we have to.
Yes.
That degree, that was another way for folks to keep us out.
Yes.
And it still is a way to keep us out. You know, it's a beautiful thing to have. I love saying Dr. Lisa. I mean, you know, I think that's extremely important. But when we wave it around, like you're only as good as the degree on your wall, that's damaging to an entire demographic of people. When people start to feel in their spirit, oh, well, because I don't have a degree, I'm not worthy of a job. I'm not worthy of a promotion within my company. That's a way that people created to keep you, to really keep us all out. Because Dr. Lisa wasn't supposed to be Dr. Lisa, right? She knows that. She knows her people, her colleagues are telling her, we're surprised that you got here. And she's a freaking doctor. So, you know, they're always going to try to find a way to move the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Just like credit, all of a sudden people use credit to
everything.
They're going to hire you. Like, really, my credit has something to do with me getting a job? That's a finish line mover. That's a way to keep moving the finish line, to keep people out that they deem, oh, you know, because that myth that all Black people have bad credit. Oh, I know. Then we'll use that to keep them out of our offices and out of our, like, it's always going to be something that they will use.
Absolutely, we can go on about this subject all day, but we're going to wrap things up with our final question. First, I have to have, because I just feel like it's so important that we point out this thing called the cliff effect.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first time I heard Tammy talk about this, I was like, that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
That is put into words. I know for me, well, I grew up poor like everybody else. Everybody else Black grew up poor. And I can't say everybody, but all the people I know.
Absolutely.
Well, I was just poor until I realized some things. But I remember vividly when I was trying to go to college and raise my oldest son. And I just knew I did not want to get a full-time job. And that if I got a full-time job, it had to be below a certain amount of money. Mm-hmm. So that I could keep my food stamps and keep my cash assistance and keep my medical.
Mm-hmm.
And when Tammy started talking about the cliff effect, I was like, yo, we need to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were so many positions I was offered. Because like I said, when I was in college, I was getting my degree in journalism. I was the president of the school newspaper and I was working for a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And I was being offered jobs and I would not take them because I was like, no. This job is right below the amount of money I need to make to be able to maintain my status as a welfare recipient.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that, Tammy. Demystify that for us.
Well, so everything that you just described is happening every single day. It's happening more now. It's happening now, and I'll tell you why. But a lot of people would turn their nose up like, I can't believe she turned down those opportunities. You did exactly probably the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you probably made the right choice, and I'm gonna tell you why. A lot of folks are receiving thousands of dollars in basic needs subsidies every month just to survive. And I'm talking about housing, I'm talking about childcare so you can go to work, I'm talking about food stamps, and I'm talking about, in a lot of cases, medical coverage, right? So those four things, those are not luxuries. Those are basic needs, things that any family, particularly a woman with children or any family with children needs to have. The reason I keep saying women is because this is who it's mostly impacting, right? So if I work a job and I'm just barely under the threshold for being eligible for those basic needs things. And think about the cost of what it is. Thousands of dollars a month for a lot of people. If you add it all up, rent, food, health insurance, childcare. Childcare alone, right? Most people can't pay childcare out of pocket, right? And if I make, let's say I make $30,000 a year and I have three children, I probably qualify for all of those things. Might not, food stamps you might get, you know, just a little bit, but it's enough to put a little bit of food on the table. And then my employer offers me a quarter raise. Think about what a quarter raise looks like. It is not enough to move your paycheck in any direction at all by the time it gets taxed to death. And so you got a little raise, which is great because that means that you're moving ahead in the, you know, in the job and the career, you're moving in the right direction. But that quarter raise is going to disqualify you from receiving a housing subsidy. It could disqualify you from being eligible for childcare subsidy. It could disqualify you from medical coverage for you and your children. And you will lose your food stamps. Now, of all of those, the food stamps, okay, we can do that. We'll figure food out. But how many people making $30,000 a year in this city can afford market rate rent, full health insurance, and childcare for three kids? I'll tell you, none. Nobody can. It's not enough money. And so if I make a decision and say, no, thank you, I can't accept that raise. Oh, that position is going to give me another dollar or two an hour. Sorry, I can't do it. Because even with two more dollars an hour, it's not enough to cover all of those things that I just talked about. It's literally thousands of dollars worth of subsidy. So if I turn it down and people are like, oh, see, these people just don't want to. They don't want the opportunities. They don't want to work. That is ridiculous, because what it really is saying is, if I come to you, Muffy, and I say, you know what, Muffy, I'm tired of this work. I think I want to be a tightrope walker. I just want to walk across tightropes at 100 feet in the air. And guess what? I don't want a safety net. I just want to free walk across this tightrope. Would you try to talk me out of it? Most people who care about me would. Yes. Right? Yes, I would. Like, girl, you crazy. What are you doing? Don't do that. This is the exact same thing. We're asking families to walk across a tightrope with no safety net in place for a quarter raise. Who's doing that? Nobody in their right mind is doing that. And so instead of making this an individualistic issue, what we should be focusing on is why that woman's making $30,000 an hour. Why have wages? Why has the minimum wage not gone up in this city and in this country, really, in the last almost 15, 20 years? Why are 1% of the people in this country earning more money than God, basically? Why do we have corporations who are so-called nonprofits that are not paying taxes, not paying their employees, not paying a livable wage, being subsidized right and left? But when a family is asking to be subsidized to survive, they're the villain, they're the enemy, they're the problem. I can't tell you enough how disgusted I am by that we refuse to hold the people who actually have the power to fix this. We don't hold them accountable. We want to focus on the person who's making a choice that is going to either shelter, feed, or provide health and protection for their children. They're the problem. It doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I just, like I said, to start, we have to take the onus off the people, right, and put it where it belongs. It belongs on the people who have created the system. That's
right, and who perpetuate it.
This, yes, is a
system issue, big time.
Keep it systemic. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, it would take less energy to just give the woman the money for the food.
It's change the eligibility criteria to meet the cost of these. I changed all of these things. Everything has to be in alignment. Wages, housing, the cost of living has to be in alignment to even begin to talk about eradicating poverty.
That's how you know, Tambi, that we're not talking about real equity and these problems are systemic, because it costs us more money to keep moms in poverty. It costs us more money to keep sending people to jail because of systemic poverty, to rehab drug addicts because of systemic poverty, to keep operating our schools in dysfunction the way that they are. I mean, it's costing the country money. So it's evident to the people who are experiencing poverty that this is an issue that is being perpetuated by a few people.
By the people who are getting rich off of a single one of those issues that you just named.
The poverty pimps. The poverty pimps.
Yeah. So, and that's the frustrating part about it, is that we all know the answers to the solutions, but we keep having these same issues over and over again.
Well, that's how I know. You know, I used to, when I came into this work, I came into it real Pollyanna-ish. I came into it all wild eye, and this is going to be great. We're going to be able to fix this. I feel completely different now, because I understand that the people who control, the people who have the power to really, really fix these issues have no desire to really fix these issues. Yeah. Right? It's really simple. The cliff effect, and we've been advocating for cliff effect change for years. The people who have the power to fix it, it's really simple. Change the eligibility criteria. It's a stroke of a pen, right? Some of these changes are not even legislative changes. Some of these changes are administrative changes, right? But it's so much easier to focus on the woman who's coming to you saying she needs help. It's so much easier to lay the blame at her feet, because that's what we do, right? And God forbid somebody says, well, here's some answers. Here's how we can fix it. Oh, no, because now you just want people to get benefits forever. Nobody wants people to get I'm the exact opposite. I don't want people on the benefits at all. Mm-hmm. I would prefer that they didn't need the benefits, sir. I would prefer that they aren't getting the money that they deserve for the labor that they produce. How about that? How about we focus on that instead? But, you know,
because that's what would inspire people to make real changes in their lives. If they had an opportunity to work for the things that they want, if they had an opportunity to give their children the things that they need so that their children could then aspire to the things that they want. And so I think, you know, we are in a position in history where I love where we are right now. Because we are, for the third time on American soil, because I think sometimes we forget to recognize that there is a constant reawakening of Black folks happening in America. It happens like every 30 to 40 years. Yeah. So we are at that place again. The question is, where do we go from here?
Right.
And what will be utilized to attempt to knock us back down? Mm-hmm. And what can we do to fight that? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think one of the things is doing what we are doing right now, which is calling a spade a spade.
Right.
Getting to that point and where we just be really, really truthful about what is happening in our communities and pushing everybody else to accept that this is the truth. Now, if you decide to bulldoze over the truth and go do something else, well, that karma is yours. Mm-hmm. But this is the truth of the experience, and this is the truth of the experts in this field. So I think we have to begin to call a spade a spade. As we wrap up, the last question I want to ask you, ladies, what do you think is the key to ending poverty? And I know that could be a very long answer, but if you had the point, I'm not even going to say one, because I don't think you could solve that in one, but what would be your summary of ending poverty?
I would say first and foremost, continuing to do what we really started to do during this election is advocating for politicians who have that on their agenda, and then making sure that we hold them accountable to make sure that if they said that they were going to try to make these changes to help improve adversity and poverty, that they definitely do that. And if they don't do it, we make sure that we vote them out for the next election and we try to bring somebody else in. And then also advocating for people in our community to become the politicians, to become the leaders, and to become the people who are at the tables making the decisions and really making an effort to break that glass ceiling like Kamala Harris did, so that we can have some people who look like that, who look like us, that can really make systemic changes, because we could do it in our homes and in our households. We could do the best that we can, but we only have a certain amount of level of power and control to help to shift that narrative. And then once again, to make it short, is we advocate for big change, and then we advocate for change in our very own houses, where we shift the mindset of our children and giving them access and exposure and to resources and education to help them shift so that they can make better decisions and shift that narrative so it no longer becomes a cycle.
Absolutely. Great. Oh, that's great, Dr. Lisa. Yes. I echo everything she said. I want to add that I think it's just not just enough to have Black people in these positions, but Black people who have experienced the thing that we're trying to solve. Because bringing that, this is what, getting folks to the table who have actually endured and who are working their tails off to get out is the voice that's missing from a lot of this work. You know, we talk about Lyndon B. Johnson's war on poverty. We've been talking about the war on poverty since the 60s. We have spent as a country almost $40 trillion saying that we are fighting against poverty. And it's just not true. People have gotten rich off of so-called poverty alleviation. You know, people are still blaming the victim. And I think in order to rectify this, we definitely have to get folks who have endured this, who know the true face of poverty, and get them at the table and help create solutions. Who else would have the better solution than the people who actually experience it? I think I agree with Dr. Lisa, political power is extremely important. Education is really important. Getting to the true history. You know, this whitewashed history that we're feeding our kids is a problem because now we have adults who don't know our history and, again, don't understand the systems and the intention around how we got where we are, right? I think people have either forgotten it or they didn't know, they never knew it ever. And it's changed, it's settled into our spirits and into our hearts that we just don't deserve more because we must have gotten ourselves here, right? And so when you, even when you aren't acknowledging that, it's in our subconscious, how we treat ourselves, how we treat our neighbors, how we treat our community is a reflection of all of the negativity that's been fed to us via the media, via politics, via how we've been treated in our own communities. And I think we have to start seeing each other with a softer eye. I think we have to recognize the power that already exists in our communities. I saw it in this COVID work. I saw neighbors helping neighbors. I saw people with the very least giving the most to their neighbor and making sure that their neighbor ate and making sure that their kids are good. So we have a collective power in our communities already. That isn't necessarily financially focused. We have a love for each other that needs to be dusted off a little bit, and we need to shine a light on that more. But we have power already. We just have to use it. We have to be able to see it. And I think we just have to do what we can for each other. There was a time when that was all we had. All we had was each other. You couldn't go somewhere else and get what you needed. So I feel like in order for us to get out of this, we have to go back to that thought process. We have to learn how to love and support each other better. We have to want for our brothers and sisters what we want for ourselves. That, you know, that's really, really important. That when I receive blessings, when I start to benefit from my work, that I'm giving that back to my neighbors. And, you know, that's I think is the one of the best ways that we're going to be able to get out of this.
Yeah, and that's the most challenging, because you hear about other cultures where, say, for example, if you're trying to build financial wealth and you're starting at the beginning of your career, you go live with, say, Aunt Lisa, who has a 4-bedroom house, and she lets you stay in that room and you don't pay her any rent, but the income that you are getting, you put that in a bank account and you save up enough money so that you're able to be successful and build your credit and get the house. And then you put a little bit in the pot for the next person that comes in. But we really don't have that a lot, because we're still struggling to figure out how we're going to make it, let alone let somebody else come in and do it and then let them stay in that space without having to pay any money.
Thank you so much, ladies. And I just want to point out that we've had an entire discussion about poverty, and we have not talked about, you know, how to get an IRA.
That's right.
Or how to budget your money, or, you know, what's the first steps to starting your child's college fund. This talk about,
but
the thing is, it goes so much deeper than that. And we have to begin to recognize that this isn't just about bankers coming into the community and offering banking services. This is a much deeper talk that needs to go into, like Dr. Lisa said, you know, that mindset shift, changing the narratives around what it means to live in poverty and the definitions that we use in terms of telling, you know, in terms of defining people who are in poverty. Mm-hmm. It goes much deeper than that. It goes into raises and the cliff effect and, you know, hunger. Let's begin to start with these community level things to have these talks about poverty before we go into, well, let's connect mom with a banker, because there's just so much stuff on the ground level that we have to begin to address in order to even begin to address the issue of how do we get moms out of poverty? How do we get Black people, period, out of poverty? So I want to thank my guests because they've been phenomenal. Thank you so much, Dr. Lisa. Thank you so much, Tammy.
Thank you.
Literally my honor this to share time with you always.
Oh yeah. I wish we had more time.
Lisa, as well as Tammy, can you tell us a little bit about where people can find you later on?
Yeah, I'm at www.drlisapickett.com and also at lpickett1 on Instagram.
You can find me at www.tammytthompson.com. You can find me also on Facebook at Halima Tammy Thompson, or on Instagram at Tammy T. Thompson.
And both of these women offer consulting services. And Tammy is also the executive director or CEO, I'm not sure, one of those two, of Catapult Pittsburgh. So make sure y'all check them out. Make sure that you go to their websites, examine the things that they have to say and the services that they have to offer. And, you know, we will see y'all next time on the Brown Mama Blueprint podcast. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you.
All right, y'all. Peace.
Bye.
Mama, thank you so much for taking care of yourself by listening to the Brown Mama Blueprint podcast. Because when you take care of you, you take care of us. To learn more about the Brown Mama movement, purchase the Brown Mama Mindset curriculum for Black moms, or to get even more tips on living your best Brown Mama life, visit brownmamas.com. Follow us on facebook.com/brownmamas or on IG at Brown Mamas Tribe. Until next time, remember that when you are a better mom, dads become better dads, children become better adults, and ultimately, our communities become better communities.